Welcome to the Hardware Asylum Podcast Extras. In this episode, we explore the benefits and limitations of water cooling from DIY to AIO. I'm your host, Dennis Garcia, and with me today, I have Darren McKay. I got an interesting comment on a YouTube video the other day, and I thought we should talk about it.
Okay, what was it?
The video was about the ROG Maximus formula, which is the one where I did an EK water cooling build.
Oh, now that's the fancy one that has the built-in water cooling system, right?
Yeah, it has the water-cooled VRM, and then EK gives you a little bridge that will connect the CPU block with the VRM blocks.
Yeah, very fancy setup.
Yeah, so I got a comment. This is from Casey. So if he's listening, hey, shout out. Thanks a lot. He says, I have a current NZXT Kraken X63. When it comes to temperature and overclocking, is the quantum momentum, which is the block that I use in this build, preferable to an AIO cooler? Is it really more aesthetic? And are the temps relatively equal?
That's a good question, actually. But I want to first talk about what we're looking at here, because I think we need to get some context. So the NZXT Kraken X63 is an all-in-one system from NZXT. Mm-hmm. And I've got the specs in front of me to make sure I get this right. So it is an all-in-one 280 millimeter, which is
two 140s.
Thank you. Got to get the math right there. Mm-hmm. All-in-one, of course, from NZXT. It's got a pretty little light show on it.
Yeah, it's got the infinity mirror thing going on with the RGB.
I like it. Now, of course, NZXT has made a nice niche for themselves in the mass market. So this is a pretty nicely priced at $150 all-in-one setup.
Oh, yeah. And that's available at Best Buy, of all places, here in the U.S. at least.
All right. So let's look at some highlights here so we know what we're comparing.
All right.
It's air cooling. It looks like they're got some nice cubic airflow, 98.17 CPs.
Yeah, almost 100 cubic feet a minute.
Noise level 38 decibels adjusted. I'm guessing it must be a variable fan. Mm-hmm. Fluid dynamic bearings. The heat sink's aluminum, which we just talked about in our main show.
Yeah, aluminum heat sink. Oh, my God.
And overall, power consumption looks pretty good. Size mm-hmm. looks good. It's probably a really nice plug-and-play system there. You know, the question, Casey, kind of infers that you're not sure if you got a great setup, and I want to assure you that you did. It's a really common, relatively highly rated system, and it, aside from, you know, a highly enthusiast-level build or adding a video card, that's a really great place to start in water cooling, and it's a little more serious with that larger heat sink radiator mm-hmm. setup. So
yeah,
a nice job on that.
Well, yeah, and my response to him was basically, we were contrasting, should you go in AIO or DIY? And basically I said, a DIY can offer lower temperatures, but only to a certain point. From a temperature and overclocking perspective, there won't be much of a change. You maybe will see 5 to 10 degrees lower temperatures with the custom loop, but that won't translate into anything more in terms of an overclock, at least with modern hardware. The reason most people go with a custom loop is because of looks, and also so that you can link multiple components together. So you can have your VRM with your CPU with your video card, and all that can be cooled by the same loop in the same radiator. It keeps the noise down, and it also will generally keep more components cool. And I go on to talk about how if you are water cooling a video card, you can see a performance gain because of the way video cards work and the boost technology from NVIDIA, where if you can keep the GPU cool, it will boost higher for longer.
Okay, lots to dissect there. So let me see if I can help with the dissection here. Well, first things first, mm-hmm. I think we should talk about water cooling and the limitations of water cooling as far as temperature, because I feel like one of the most common things, or maybe misconceptions, if you will, is that just by going to water cooling, you can lower your temperature down like crazy, like sub-zero.
And, sub-zero, oh my gosh.
And I know that is not the case, but you know, seeing as we have the expert in the house, Dennis, mm-hmm. tell me, what kind of temperatures can you expect, and what affects the temperatures of an AIO water cooling system? I mean, we are definitely not getting below ambient, right?
No. So with water cooling and air cooling, actually, any sort of cooling that transmits heat to air, you can never get below the ambient temperature of the surrounding air. And in my reviews on hardwareasylum.com, I test how effective the heatsink is with the ambient temperature. So I have the ambient temperature, and we look at the temperature difference between the two, and that's how effective the heatsink is at removing heat. Now, the temperature of your CPU will change based off of your ambient air. So like if I'm outside and it's snowing and it's like right? close to zero, I'm going to get a pretty good CPU temperature because the ambient air is a lot lower.
And that's with the same equipment because the ambient temperature is lower.
Exactly. Now, if I have it in the house and it's 120 degrees outside and the air conditioner is busted, then my CPU is going to get hot because the ambient temperature is a lot higher than it was in the wintertime. You need to make sure your case is adequately cooled to ensure that your CPU and your GPU are also adequately cooled.
Right. We do talk quite a bit about that in this month's main episode. So if you haven't checked that out yet, jump back over to that for a little more talk about air cooling. But I thought we should get that out of the way because I know when I was first getting into water cooling, my expectation was the temperature would be much better than even a good air cooling system. And I think, and we've talked about this before, but I think it's important to point out that a really good air-cooled system, a tower or the like, can outperform some of these all-in-one water cooling systems.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of, like Noctua, for instance. They have a couple of dual tower coolers with 140 millimeter fans that will rival an AIO. And that is actually unheard of because this is an air-cooled tower heatsink comparatively to a water cooler that has a lot more heat capacity and being able to actually remove the heat from inside the case to outside the case. And that's actually one of the key points as well. It depends on scale. You know, if you have a low powered CPU and a really big heatsink, it's going to be cool because there's no way you're going to saturate the heatsink with heat.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about why do people water cool? I mean, what's the history there?
Well, water cooling has actually, it has deep roots. So it goes back into the enthusiast modding days when we would take heater cores out of like Pentos. Right?
And that then just sounds silly. Yeah, I know. But it's true.
And then we'd adapt them with vinyl tubing that we get from, you know, a big box home improvement store. You know, we'd like to call
fish it tank tubing.
Fish tank tubing, yes. And then we would get a pond pump because those are readily available and link all that stuff together with a water block that we might make out of a copper block that we take a Dremel and cut a bunch of lines into and then solder the whole thing together. Or if you had access to it, you could braze it together, put a couple of hose barbs on it so that it can would create a complete water loop. So you could run the water through this block that you just made and mount it to your CPU with some zip ties, run the water into this heater core with some fans on it.
Oh my.
With a pond pump running through there. And the intent was to provide better cooling so that you could overclock better. And the idea there was with this old hardware like Pentium 4s and Athlon XPs, the colder you could get the chip, the higher you could actually push your clocks. It was really almost a one-to-one. So if you could drop it by 10 degrees, you could get another 100 to 200 megahertz out of it and actually have it stable to the point where you could run benchmarks, game for days, what have you.
Well, I think we've talked about the term below ambient, which of course means that we are able to get a temperature below the ambient temperature of the room. And to do that requires special equipment. So I know there's history there too.
Well, and we did a video on that actually. You remember that one where we cooled a Core i9-9900K with vodka?
Oh, yes. A great video.
That's a great one. We'll link that one down in the show notes. But the cliff notes there is I hooked my single stage phase up to a water cooling loop. It had no radiator. Basically, the phase was cooling the entire loop. And we used vodka as the water, well, the liquid in this case, because vodka doesn't freeze when it gets below zero. And that way, we could overclock our CPU below ambient in a water cooling loop.
So let me bring it back a little bit to the history, because I know we talked a lot about the origins, the do-it-yourself movement, and having to source parts from some pretty radical places. But, but let's bring it back to how did we get more to the mainstream there? How did water cooling become more, I guess, consistent in the PC market?
Manufacturers are kind of funny. They look at the enthusiasts for ideas. You know, so we have enthusiasts that go and improve case cooling by cutting holes out in the back of their case to add bigger fans, right? So what do? They add bigger fans. We start cutting holes in the side of cases to add windows. They start adding windows. Well, we have these water cooling loops that we're making ourselves. Well, they have access to CNC machines. So what do manufacturers do? Like Asetek, for instance, they go and make a DIY kit using their CNC technology to go and create water blocks for the CPU. They make water blocks for the GPU. They make water blocks for the chipset. And then they put it together with a small radiator that Black Ice was one of the first companies to start making these radiators. Well, they paired with Black Ice to offer a radiator for this loop. And believe it or not, they paired it all with a pond pump.
Oh, wow. I guess you got to start somewhere.
Well, you do. And their innovation there was that they could create better water blocks more consistently, and they had better fittings. So they had these tubes that would be a push lock. So as long as the bottom was cut straight and you pushed them in, they would never leak. And the only way to remove them was to actually use a special tool, push this little tab down and pull the hose out. Well, of course, there are enthusiasts that can go and create their blocks on their own. You know, the white water block. You remember that one? That was a really popular one back in the Pinning 4 days. Well, that was one of the first blocks that was made by the enthusiast community that had three hose barbs on it. And the idea there was that if you could get the water to enter the block directly over the CPU, and back in these days, it was just a single core, if you could have the water enter the middle and exit out the side, you could get better performance. And the Danger Den also did one that's called the RBX block. It was very similar to that. Instead of having thin slices going out to these two blocks, they actually put a little wave pattern in there. And that wave pattern created more surface. More surface means better cooling. As block designs enhanced, so did performance.
So that's kind of interesting because we pieced it together back in the day. Mm-hmm. And then we moved into these kits, I guess.
Yeah.
But I know that the market flourished in different ways with sites like Frozen CPU, for example, where we were bringing various pieces of parts to the market.
Well, yeah, the e-tailers started actually sourcing their products from the manufacturers that were making them. So they would source products from Asetek, for instance, and sell their kits. They would source the whitewater blocks that were actually sold in web forms. Remember those things, right? They would actually say, hey, we want to sell your blocks. So they would actually put them on their web store and actually start selling them from there so that more people could buy these blocks from a reputable seller.
So again, we're limited to the availability of the parts as the manufacturers caught up with the enthusiasts. Mm-hmm. But you've mentioned some other types of extreme cooling also. I want to make sure that we talk about those because water cooling can't go below ambient except for in some specific cases.
Right.
And manufacturers have tackled that, I know, in a couple of different ways.
Well, we have Coolit, for instance. You remember that company?
Well, of course, yeah. They were a big part of my early overclocking adventures.
Yeah, well, they had the Eliminator, which was an all-in-one cooling solution. It had its own little water block and its own little self-contained pump, but they also added Peltiers to supplement the cooling capacity of the radiator. So it would really make this system a lot cooler because it added more cooling.
Well, and the hope was that a Peltier could help you break that barrier, right, and get below ambient.
Or at least get it as close as possible to below ambient. You know, we have the Sub-Zero from Cooler Master that just came out, you know, with a Peltier that was water-cooled. But that was kind of an old technology that was really invented during this time back in the past. So it was really how can we enhance water cooling or cooling in general to make the system more efficient, quieter, or overclock better?
Well, I know that was a dangerous thing for a while, different types of chillers to your water cooling loop, because you had to be very careful not to make the water too cold for obvious reasons.
Yeah, you don't want to freeze it.
And so it was really difficult to modulate those, which is why that kind of came and went. But that's not the only technology that came and went. I know there were some others, like Zalman, for example.
Oh, are you talking about the Zalman Tower?
That's right. External cooling towers were a thing for, thankfully, a fairly short period of time. Yeah.
Well, they had two types of that. They had one that was water-based. It had this little tower that would, well, not little. It was actually a really big tower that would sit outside of your case. And the idea there was that it would be completely air-cooled. you wouldn't need to have any active cooling at all. So it could be nearly silent aside from the pump. And then they had other cases that had heat pipes that would connect to large heat sinks that were the case itself. It really only worked with a couple of motherboards, but it was short-lived because it was expensive and really difficult to build in.
Well, I remember those cases were really sought after because for a while an aluminum case would give you just a little bit more heat transfer. And looking back, that just seems silly because it was so little, but every little bit, right?
Well, yeah. And with overclocking, every little bit did help. But this was also during the era of single and dual and early quad-core CPUs. The way they were designed, you could overclock them by just making them colder, provided you had the motherboard that could handle the voltage and whatnot, but they did not boost. That is a key point that separates old hardware from new hardware, including video cards. Well, you have this technology called boost, where the factory is now overclocking your CPU and GPU for you.
Well, it's interesting to say that because I know video card cooling has gone through some evolutions, maybe even revolutions, mm-hmm. with the way that they've cooled over time, from venting out the back, venting into the case, passive and active cooling, multiple slots even. But I think maybe that's a story for a different time.
Well, yeah, I mean, we have the full coverage water block that was invented. I want to say it was invented by Danger Den, although I think EK might also have a claim to that as well.
Right, right.
But the design there was that we have this separate daughter board, which is the GPU, that needed to have the memory and the GPU and the VRM cooled all at the same time. And the best way to do that was with one big piece of copper that was laid across the entire card. You run water through a channel, you can cool the entire card. With the boost technologies of the modern GPUs, the cooler you can keep the card, the more it will boost and the better overall performance you can get. Well, with early cards, the colder you could get the card, the more you could overclock it. It's kind of the same thing. It's like we are manually overclocking it because we can keep the temperature down, whereas the manufacturers now are just kind of saying, well, if you built your case right or water cool your GPU, we can actually give you more performance.
Well, I think that's not a bad, at least, overview of the history of water cooling, but I want to talk more about some of the modern applications. Mm-hmm. For example, the Maximus, right?
So with the Maximus formula, the difference there between some of the other water-enabled motherboards is that the VRM is a dual cooler. So you can run water through it, or you could leave it as an air-cooled heatsink.
Well, let me hold you up there a little bit, because it hasn't been that long since we had to have active cooling and sometimes even aftermarket cooling on our North Bridge, or was it the South Bridge?
Yeah.
Or both. I it's been a while, but how does that... I mean, are we talking about the same thing with these full coverage motherboards?
We are. And a good example of that would be the Gigabyte Z390 that we used at the Hackfort demonstration.
Right.
That motherboard came with a full coverage water block that would cool the VRM, the CPU, and the MCP, or the South Bridge, all within the same big copper plate. So it's really taking a lot of the cooling advances that they made with GPUs and applying it to a motherboard. The difference there is that this block is huge, is really heavy, and it really didn't translate into better performance. It's more of a looks thing in terms of the modern water cooling systems.
Well, there's definitely a cost involved in that type of coverage too.
Yeah, that board was close to $1,000.
Holy cow. So let's talk about these modern ones. I know that we've talked about the Maximus, the formula, mm-hmm. because it has, I think, the most unique setup because of the multiple water blocks.
It's the multiple water cooling options.
There we go.
So we have the water-cooled VRM that you can decide to use or decide to just leave it on air. Now, if you add a DIY water block to it, or an AIO for that matter, you're just cooling the CPU. You're not cooling any of the other components. EK created a bridge that would connect with their water block that you can put over the CPU, and then connect the water channels from the CPU to the VRM back to the CPU so that there's only a water in and a water out. That is really the biggest benefit to this little bridge. Instead of having a tube go from the CPU to the VRM, back to the CPU, back to whatever else you need to have actually cooled.
So, of course, we'll link to the video in the show notes of the ROG Maximus 12 formula.
Yeah, wow. It's kind of big.
And the EK Quantum Momentum Cooling System. But I don't know if you've done a great job of describing it, because in my mind, when I think about a bridge, I'm thinking about something that physically moves from one place to another with some space between. And this bridge sits on top of the water cooling, so it's more to me like layers of a water cooling cake.
Your description is quite accurate, really. So the idea with the EK bridge is that it's linking these two water cooling components together. Now, in an ideal situation, we would want to have a direct connection so that it's all one piece of copper, right? So we have a CPU block that's cooling the VRM at the exact same time. Well, this bridge is really just kind of spanning the gap between what is offered from EK on an ASUS motherboard with another EK product. While it really gives you the option to link the two together, I find it to be a little bit obtrusive. It looks good, but it's also, it adds more points of failure. So there's a trade-off there.
Well, and another trade-off, because I'm sure that doesn't come cheap.
No, it does add a little bit of cost. I mean, each one of those water blocks, you can probably write down $200 for every block that you want to add to any sort of a water cooling loop.
Ouch.
I mean, some of them might be a little cheaper. You might be able to get $150, but then your VGA block might be $350. So, you know, figure $200.
But for $150, you can also get an NZXT Kraken system.
Exactly, and it's all self-contained. Some people like to say the all-in-ones are really just kind of an air cooler on steroids, and really that's not far off, really. We have an air cooler, and the idea with the air cooler is that you have this tower, you are transmitting heat into the surrounding air. That surrounding air is inside your case, provided your case cools extremely well, you're not going to see any detriment at all. With an all-in-one cooler, you have the power of liquid being able to absorb a lot more heat and handle a lot more heat and be able to transmit it from point A to another point. And in this case, the radiator can be attached to the outside of your case and you're venting this heat outside of the case.
Well, I know in your response to Casey's post there, you mentioned that you could get with an aftermarket gains of maybe 5 or 10 degrees, which doesn't really sound like a lot, especially when we're talking about hundreds, maybe thousands of dollars difference in cooling.
Yeah, and that's more or less the efficiency, right? So we have an air cooler where we have an average temperature of, say, 50 degrees centigrade. You move to an AIO, you'll get an average temperature of maybe 37 to 40 degrees centigrade. If you go with a DIY loop with a very similar sized radiator and fans, it might go down another 5 degrees. At that point, you can start tweaking things. So you can say, I want to go and add a much larger radiator. Well, that will get you closer to ambient temperature because you can move more heat out of the system because you have a much larger radiator, more surface area. More surface area is better. Much like in the tuning world when you're trying to make your Honda go much, much faster, right? You can start tweaking things with a DIY loop. You can use a different coolant. You know, you don't want to use vodka unless you're going to pair it with a single stage phase, right?
And a good drink.
That way you can get the whole system a lot cooler. But if you are using, say, for instance, like a C1000 coolant, you can run a much lower ambient temperature because of the glycol in the coolant doesn't freeze at zero. Where if you're using pure distilled water, it will freeze at zero. So it really depends on the ambient. But then again, not everybody lives in Antarctica or in the North Pole where it is cold all the time.
Well, and not everybody's looking for big overclocking numbers either.
No, and that is really comes back to the question that was asked at the YouTube video. Will I get better performance using a DIY loop, you know, like the EK components, or do I stick with my AIO? Well, AIOs have actually become one of the de facto standards for cooling of a single component. The efficiency there is that these AIOs are actually really good. They have much larger radiators. They don't make a lot of noise. But if you want to link more than one component together to benefit from the water cooling, that's when you go with the DIY solution. You know, linking AIOs together can be done. I mean, AlphaCool with the IceBear system. It was kind of a all-in-one solution that allows you to expand the system. But it was based off a DIY loop. It just happened to be self-contained.
Well, I think those kits kind of bridge the gap between AIO and a full do-it-yourself system too. And we've talked about quite a few of those on the site with the reviews and articles that we've posted there. Mm-hmm. So there is, I think, a in-between stage even that will help folks that are trying to bridge from an AIO to a full DIY solution rather.
Well, and there's another aspect to the question that we also kind of addressed early on in this episode, where what kind of overclocking numbers can I get by changing? And that really comes down to the modern hardware and how it has changed.
Right.
So we talked about the boost. All the CPUs, all the GPUs now have this boost characteristic, whereas CPUs and GPUs from 10 years ago, they were, you bought something at 2.4 gigahertz, it ran at 2.4 gigahertz unless you told it to not run at 2.4, unless you told it not to run at 2.4 gigahertz. To make it go faster, you make it cooler because it's going to generate a lot more heat and whatnot. Well, modern CPUs and GPUs have this boost technology. So if you can keep them cool, they will overclock for you. So you're buying a 3.4, it's going to boost to 5 every once in a while. Well, there's no headroom there for overclocking beyond that point. And if you really want to get beyond that, you need to go below ambient. You're going to be running LN2. You're going to be running a dry ice or a single stage phase. And that's going to take something a lot more than, you know, your AIO Kraken that you buy from Best Buy for $150.
Well, Dennis, of course, there is one other reason that you should consider water cooling or even a good AIO system. And that is something we haven't talked about. Mm-hmm. One of the main reasons that people pick water cooling besides performance is because it's quiet. And that's true of a good AIO system too, especially if you get a nice big radiator.
Well, yeah. And the quietness comes from two factors. So if you are benchmarking, well, we're going to use this as a benchmark, I guess, air cooling. To keep a tower cool on top of the CPU, a lot of times that fan has to spin really, really fast. And if your case is not adequately cooled, it's going to see a higher than average CPU temperature. So the fan is just going to make a lot more noise to try and keep that temperature low as possible.
And that in-case temperature will also cause the fans from your GPU, your video card, to spin mm-hmm. faster because they're trying to keep up, and could also affect the performance of your power supply if you have a variable power supply fan. So in general, there is a lot of potential for noise when your system is performing at a hot level.
And if you go with a water cooling loop where you can remove that heat from inside the chassis to outside, you lower that threshold. It makes everything just run a lot smoother. So your CPU is not going to be running as hot. It's not going to have as high as ambient temperature. That's not to say that your GPU won't be impacted by that. But then again, with the DIY loop, you can link that in, and then all of a sudden you're removing all of the heat at once.
And water cooling looks kind of cool too.
Yeah, there's that looks aspect too. And that's something that was brought up in the YouTube comment was, is this really an aesthetic decision or is it really a performance decision?
At the end of the day, Dennis, I think that it really just boils down to two things. What are you trying to do with your build, and really just how much you want to spend?
For more information on the topics discussed in this podcast, please consult our show notes at hardwareasylum.com. Stay up to date on the latest at Hardware Asylum by subscribing to our RSS. Follow us on Twitter or like us on Facebook. This has been a Ninja Lane production, copyright 2021. Thanks for listening.